From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. A 19-year-old gunman killed 17 people with an AR-15 at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, about 3 weeks ago. The United States has had to deal with its share of school shootings, but it was after this February 14th tragedy that the conversation around gun rights, gun control, and how those issues impact American kids fundamentally shifted. Just yesterday, Florida passed a bill that raises the legal age for buying a firearm from 18 to 21. It institutes a 3-day waiting period for most weapons, bans bump stocks, and arms school employees. There's also funding for mental health services and more school security. No word yet on whether Governor Rick Scott will sign that bill. We've seen the students from that Florida high school making the rounds on news networks insisting on stricter gun control. A majority of Republican lawmakers in tight congressional races are changing their message on guns, expressing new support for restrictions, according to a Reuters review of the candidates' public statements. New Hanover County officials recently held a school safety roundtable, which included members of law enforcement, public school, and elected officials. The Star News reported that the big takeaway related to mental health awareness, more resources for mental health, and perhaps training cafeteria workers and custodians to spot signs of mental illness. Is school safety a conversation about security protocols, gun control, gun rights, mental illness? Today we'll hear from four people who are members of the community and connected to New Hanover County Public Schools, one parent and three high school students. Our goal today is to understand how they're thinking and talking about gun rights in America, whether they feel their schools are safe, and what, if anything, needs to change. With us now is Tia Johnson. She's a senior at Hoggard High School, and she is the student body president. Tia Johnson, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Also with us now, Cooper Whitehead. He is also a senior at Hoggard High School, and he is in the Ivy Diploma Program. Welcome, Cooper Whitehead.
Thank you for having me.
And we're inviting you to join the conversation. Has Florida changed the way you think about guns? Why or why not? Is the new talk of gun control hysteria, in your view, and a failure of other mechanisms like mental health services or law enforcement? Do you think this is a pivot point in gun history for the United States? You can reach us during this live Thursday discussion at 910-343-1138 or via email at coastline@whqr.org. I want to start with an email from Lauren. She writes, "I was in high school when Columbine happened. I had never before been scared for my safety at school. That one day changed my perspective forever. I now have a daughter in elementary school. Every day that I drop her off at school, I watch her walk into the building and think, is this going to be the day that something happens here? I love our community, but it is our responsibility to advocate for the safety of our children." And she talks about her views on gun laws, which we can get to in a little bit. But Tia Johnson, has Parkland, Florida changed the way you think and talk about guns in America?
I wouldn't say it necessarily has changed my views on guns, but it has amplified the importance of speaking out and making new laws and regulations about it. And it's really made it more real for me how easily it could happen and made me want to get involved in making a change about it, too.
Why do you think this school shooting had such an impact?
This one is definitely different from previous ones because of the outspokenness of the survivors and the students and how they've made it to where we can't just ignore it. They're talking to congressmen and being upfront about it, and I think it's might actually make a difference this time with this one.
Cooper Whitehead, how did this Florida shooting change or not the way you think and talk about guns?
This issue kind of hit me hard in a personal way. I with previous shootings, whether it was the Orlando nightclub or Sandy Hook, you know, I felt bad, kind of had the condolences. But this one, I don't know, it's because of the fact that if I'm in high school now, like maybe like the woman of Columbine, that hits her. But this hit me in a way that I kind of feared for my safety, and I kind of started acknowledging what would happen in my own school if this was to happen. And I realized it wouldn't probably be much different given our circumstances and stuff. So I really think that there needs to be a change in our society because of this, and maybe even in our laws. This is something I hadn't felt before with regards to shootings or anything, but now I do.
But why do you think this landed on you differently than some of the other ones?
Maybe it was a connection as me as a high schooler, or the fact that I think that if there were laws in place that say that Florida has proposed their legislative body, I think that this could have been prevented, or not to the degree that it was carried out.
Tia Johnson, how did your parents raise you around guns, to think about guns? Were you raised with guns in the house?
Well, I was a military child, so my father does have guns. They weren't very present in the house, weren't really discussed much, but I would definitely say my parents have raised me to be aware of the potential dangers of guns and what they can do. And yeah, but
did you have a gun in the house as security? I mean, is that something that you always knew was there?
Yes. Had guns as security, but wasn't really made to think like, oh, we need this gun, you know, be always aware on the edge, but they were there.
When you think about, you know, you're in high school now, so you're mm-hmm. still living with your parents, I assume. Mm-hmm. When you think about graduating from college and going out on your own, do you imagine that you'll have your own weapon?
Me personally, I don't feel that I need to be armed on a everyday basis. So personally, I would say no.
Cooper Whitehead, how were you raised around guns?
Well, with my case, it's between my father's family and my mother's family. No one was opposed to guns, but one side of my family was definitely, they had possession of firearms, whereas the others didn't. And I was taught from a young age that the primary function of a firearm is indeed to kill. But I was taught that the gun is not what kills an individual. It's the person that pulls the trigger. But that said, I'd never seen a firearm till I was 9 years old, and I asked my grandfather if I could go out and shoot one day. And so what he did is, before this event took place, I was given proper safety lessons by him. And he's not certified or anything, but he was trained by a former soldier, his father, with regards to firearms. So before I even touched a weapon, I was told, you know, what it was meant to do, what it was capable of, and to respect it as a tool. And so I was raised in an environment with guns, and not necessarily glorifying guns, but learning how to respect them as a tool. And as Tia said, kind of like the potential of what they can do.
And so do you think that before this Florida shooting happened, you would have been more of an advocate for Second Amendment rights and gun rights in America?
With regards to Second Amendment rights, I think possession and the right to bear arms is a constitutional right, but I think the way we interpret that, there should be some amendments to maybe the age which we purchase it or the qualifications for owning a firearm. I don't believe that an individual has to be 21 to buy a beer, but yeah, at 18 they can go and buy an Armalite rifle. I think that there's a discrepancy there in how we entrust people within our nation and how we deal out responsibilities to what we call adults.
Has your thinking changed on that in the last few weeks? Like before Parkland, would you have said?
Yes, I would say there's been I've always kind of felt like some of our rules were out of place, but now I feel like there needs to be definite change with regards to our laws.
Tia Johnson, what are the changes that you think need to be made around guns?
Kind of like what Cooper said, the qualifications of what it takes to get a gun and the age, but also the specific types of guns. Shouldn't have access to mass murdering weapons or bump stocks, and they're just not necessary in everyday life, and they put people in danger and make these situations able to happen, which they never should.
Did either of you hear about the school safety roundtable conducted by New Hanover County? I believe it was last week. And if so, what did you think of that conversation? Do you feel like they're kind of getting to the guts of what needs to be talked about? Cooper.
I had a teacher discuss that this discussion actually did take place, and I'm going to preserve the teacher's name so we don't call her out. But the teacher discussed how that they felt like that this was more just a publicity stunt, if I can be blunt with that, and that the elected officials of the county were tiptoeing around issues that necessarily wouldn't solve what was that final issue. And the man in Parkland, or the former student, he had mental health issues. That was evident, but that's not what killed other people. Was his ability to go and purchase a firearm. And from what the teacher said regarding that this roundtable, that issues of school safety weren't necessarily discussed, and it was more societal issues, and that they weren't really talking about implementing anything that could change how we would respond to an event like this that could see students hurt or possibly killed.
They did talk a lot about mental health awareness and issues around that, and possibly providing more mental health services. Do you think, I mean, Cooper, you said earlier that it's not, you were raised to understand that it's not guns that kill people on their own. It's people misusing guns that kill people.
Yeah, I see guns as a tool, and that this was the first issue with the individual. I mean, the cops had been called on over a dozen times on the individual by his foster parents. The kid was kicked out of school for violence. And the mental health is an issue, but what's hard for me is to bear arms is a constitutional right. And so when we get to this issue of an individual who hasn't been flagged down but should, I think by making amends to these constitutional rights, maybe setting requirements before purchasing a firearm, you could prevent this, because he did have the intent to kill, and he did carry out this assault with a rifle, a semi-automatic rifle. But I believe that if we implemented certain requirements for guns, this wouldn't happen.
Tia Johnson, how safe do you feel in school today?
In school, I feel like we don't have a set-in plan of what exactly to do. I feel like the student body, we know we're supposed to lock the door, sit in the corner, you know, be quiet and hide, but I feel as though we haven't been made to feel, or we haven't been taught exactly what to do and made to feel safe where, God forbid if this were to happen, that we would be taken care of 100%. And I feel like that's a hard task for faculty to tackle. So,
do you think that school officials, teachers, employees of the school system should be armed, Tia?
I definitely do not believe that. And I would say, I can confidently say that the majority of students would agree with me that we would not feel comfortable with teachers being armed. And
why? Why? What's scary about that?
Well, my belief is you can't solve gun issues with more guns. That just doesn't make sense to me. And just adding more guns to school is just making more access to casualties that happen like this. And it's just not safe at all.
Cooper Whitehead, can you see arming teachers or employees in the school as one segment of the solution?
Across the board, I don't like the idea of teachers walking around with rifles or handguns, but with regards to certain individuals on staff, if they were trained properly, or I know within our own school, people have talked about certain individuals that have former military training, they're stable with regards to their mental health, I would not be opposed to one or two of these individuals having a firearm that's secure, maybe locked in a safe where only they had access to, because Parkland, in the days following, we found out that there was a school resource officer on campus, on site, who took up a defensive measure and failed to prevent this individual from carrying out murder. When issues like this happen, the only way to help people, as unfortunately counter-terrorist and police units around the world are discovering due to recent events, is to engage the shooter. So my faith in the police force has kind of been lost because of this one individual. I'm not saying that that's reflective on all school resource officers or sheriffs or whatever you want to say, but I feel like the most immediate way to an effective way to take out an individual that's conducting themselves in a manner where they're hurting other people is an immediate threat to them. And if that would be from one or two trained and certified staff members being armed, I would not be opposed to that. But this idea of giving teachers across the board access to firearms, I think that's a bit extreme and not necessary.
We have an email from Bob who writes, in some European countries, you may not own a rifle unless you have a hunting license. Why not have the same requirement here? What do you think And I'll ask you first, Cooper, is that too, are we starting to impinge on constitutional rights when we go that far?
With regards to that, I would say we are. Europe has a history of 2 millennia's worth of war and just destruction due to the events of the last century. I think Europe is very wary of guns. In America, the idea of guns in the Constitution is not for hunting. That is never mentioned. The idea within the American Constitution is the idea of a civilian populace being armed so that they can protect themselves from a tyrannical state. Versus in European nations, the idea is for a certified individual to have it to hunt or to collect, or in some European states, they actually mandate that all citizens have guns or training, but that is for the preservation of their state. Within our Constitution, it's the opposite. It's the preservation of the civilian body against the state. So I'm not going to say I'm opposed or against the idea of only people that use guns for hunting or other purposes having it, but I don't see that as being constitutionally possible within our society.
Tia Johnson, final word very briefly. You can wave a magic wand and you get your wish. What happens with guns?
I would definitely say just more laws being able to prevent people that don't need guns from getting them, and more mental health awareness and resources for that, so this will never happen again.
Tia Johnson, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. When we come back from this break, we'll meet one parent who has 3 students in local public schools, and we want to hear from you on this Thursday. What does the conversation on guns and Second Amendment rights sound like around your dinner table these days? Call us and tell us about it during this live Thursday discussion at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today we're meeting 3 local students and 1 parent to find out how they're talking about school safety, how safe they feel here in the Cape Fear region, and whether their conversation around gun rights and gun control is changing after the Florida school shooting last month. Joining us now is Kelly Sechrist. She has 3 kids in local public schools, 2 in different high schools,
yes,
and 1 in middle school.
Yes.
Kelly Sechrist, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you for having me on here.
And still with us, Cooper Whitehead. He's a senior at Hoggard High School, and we're inviting you to join the conversation. What do you think contributes to safer schools? Give us a call and tell us about it on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. Kelly Sechrist, did this Florida event on February 14th change the way you feel about your own kids' safety in school?
I think every time we see one of these events happen, it makes us more aware of the issues we have in the United States. Certainly, we've had other incidents leading up to this, starting with Columbine. I remember that very well. I was a college student then and remember being fearful. I was actually on campus at Chapel Hill during a shooting, very scary time. But, I think that we finally, with Parkland, are realizing that our community has to come together with some kind of solution from both sides of the picture and the argument.
And what would that solution look like?
You know, I think that's something that we have really got to take a multifaceted approach to. Certainly, we have to start with gun control and figuring out a way to stay within the bounds of our Constitution, but also to protect our children, protect our citizens from violence in this manner. And, what that really looks like is taking a look very strongly at background checks, at the types of ammunition that we allow, the types of firearms that we allow in this country, to really see how we can tamp this problem down, I guess, from the legal side. I think we also need to take a look at mental health. I think we need to take a look at resourcing our schools appropriately so that children don't fall through the cracks. You know, we in the past year, especially in North Carolina, we have cut and cut and cut from our schools and not funded them even for basics like copier paper. Well, that's got to change. We've got to make, you know, our children a priority. Yeah.
And Lauren, who wrote earlier about being in high school when Columbine happened and talks about how that changed her life. She'd never before been scared for her safety when she was in school. She writes, "Common sense gun laws are a must. There is absolutely no need for a private citizen to have access to these assault rifles. They were created to kill as many people as quickly as possible. They are not for hunting or protecting one's home. Whenever there is a tragedy like Parkland, Sandy Hook, we shake our heads in disbelief, pray for change, and hug our children tighter. But enough is enough. Our elected officials have an obligation to protect all of the citizens in this area and all over the country." Cooper Whitehead, you've talked a little bit about what the Second Amendment means to you, but is this kind of a moving target? That's probably a bad phrase to use in this conversation. But when it comes to what it means around the kinds of firearms people can own, how do you find that spot where you're not violating the rights? But
I think our interpretation of the Constitution kind of has to be more clearly outlined. For instance, I believe it was in the 1930s that Congress passed the law essentially forbidding people to own automatic firearms such as machine guns or rifles that could sustain fire. And so I don't know, given our current climate and just the precedent that's been set over recent years, if we could do that. But I do see there's a huge issue with regards to how guns are classified. Most states classify guns in two categories, handguns and long guns. Handguns obviously being pistols, and long guns pretty much cover anything else. It can be a shotgun, or it could be a 100-year-old bolt-action rifle, or the type of rifle used in Parkland. And I think that there's a huge discrepancy there, and that some people in most states have to be 21 to purchase a handgun, but at 18 you can buy one of these rifles that have been used repeatedly in mass shootings to take out dozens of people. And I think there needs to be a change with that. I don't know if you could take it away constitutionally, given our current set of laws and just the legal precedents, but I think that there should be a distinction between a firearm that's meant to fire over 20 rounds a minute versus one that you're going to take 10 seconds to load. I think there needs to be a distinction there, and more background checks and more just common sense laws with regards to owning those and acquiring those.
Where are we failing on the background check point, Kelly Sechrist?
You know, I think we just have to toughen that up to make the waiting periods longer, to a national database. You know, when I go to the drugstore to purchase cold medicine, I'm entered into a national database so that when I go to Georgia or South Carolina or California, they know how much Claritin D I bought. The same thing should ring true for guns. We need to close the loopholes that allow people to purchase guns privately. Without the standard checks, we need to close the loopholes that allow people to go to gun shows and purchase guns. We really have got to figure out, you know, how to best license our people to use the guns responsibly and the right types of guns, as Cooper suggested.
We've heard people talk about, you know, increasing background checks and, you know, widening the scope of what kind of data is examined in those background checks. And the issue of mental health and mental health history has come up. Some people argue that is a problem because it could discourage generally mentally healthy people, people who don't have serious mental health issues, from actually going and getting care, mental health care, when they need it, you know, going through a divorce or struggling with a change in their lives or, you know, oh no, that might show up now on my background check. How do we find that kind of a line, Cooper Whitehead?
That's an issue that I wish I had an answer for, or I really don't know. I know that within the U.S., around two-thirds, over 22,000 gun deaths a year are attributed to suicide, and that the CDC regards or believes that around 90% of suicide victims do have mental health issues. So I'm not sure if there's a way to standardize how we view everyone's mental health and then how we convert that to their legal access to firearms. I think that's a broader societal issue, but if we want to prevent things like Parkland or Sandy Hook, I think that there needs to be more immediate checks and just greater communication between local, state, and federal government on issues regarding, say, an individual's community involvement or whatever they've done to benefit the community or harm the community before they purchase a firearm. So I don't know with regards to the mental health, but I think there need to be databases that are shared between state, local, and federal governments so we know who we're giving out these weapons to and what they've done.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about guns in America, safe schools, and how local students and parents feel about it in the Cape Fear region. With us right now, Kelly Sechrist. She's the parent of three children in local public schools, with one in middle school and two kids in different high schools. And Cooper Whitehead, a senior at Hoggard High School. What part of the discussion around guns do you think we're missing? If you could create the safest schools in the country, what would you do? Give us a call on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. We're going to get to a couple of emails in a second, but Kelly Sechrist, three kids going off to schools every day. Do you feel like they're safe, specifically when you think about the schools to which your kids are going?
That's a great question. I think when I take a look, I'll take it school by school. That might be a little bit easier. When I look at our middle school, the campus is one closed, contained building. The access to the campus is more limited, one way in, one way out. They do have a system. When you go to the front door of the school, you have to be buzzed in. They can see you from the front office. See who you are. So I do feel relatively safe. I don't think we can make an assumption, however, that we are. I think we still have to be diligent. We have to be watching our campuses. We have to be, you know, utilizing cameras and utilizing, you know, certainly our SRO officers are so important on our campuses. But as a general rule, I do think the middle school campus is fairly safe. As far as Laney and Hoggard go, and we were actually discussing this earlier with the students, you know, they are college campus style campuses. There are multiple buildings, there are trailers, there are open areas. When students are evacuated for fire drills, they all go to one area. They're similar campuses. I do not feel like it is an easy, conducive place to lock down. You know, they sit on the corners of busy intersections. North College is busy. Shipyard Boulevard is busy. And I think it's very difficult to maintain a secure facility in that type of environment. So,
what's the antidote to that?
You know, I'm not really sure, and that breaks my heart, because I do think, you know, when we look at something like Parkland, and I visualize my children walking into school that day, what if they had been on that campus, and what if they had been the ones that were, you know, injured or killed or hiding in the classroom? It's heartbreaking. I do not think that arming our staff in our schools, that, you know, putting armed guards outside every door, anything like that, is an appropriate place for a learning environment. I do think that we are going to have to approach this from the gun control side, from the mental health side, from the, you know, staffing our schools appropriately, providing the resources appropriately to really make a difference in the problem, rather than just band-aiding it with another gun here or another officer here.
We have an email from Catherine who writes, I thought it might be worth mentioning on March 14th, there will be a Facebook Live and Twitter Periscope with a student panel on gun violence and school safety. Even though we don't live in Wake County, we can still participate and let our students' voices be heard. She gives us a link on Facebook. In the wake of Parkland, Florida, students across the country have decided to stand up and take action, calling for change and new policies. It's time we show them we're listening. So we will post that on our website. Cooper Whitehead, what kinds of activities in school, if any, are you involved in or are you seeing kind of coalescing around this issue?
Definitely a lot of discussion over the last couple of weeks, and everyone's pretty much come to the mindset, if that was to happen where I go to school, Hoggard, what would we do? And the issue of Hoggard, as Ms. Sechrist said, is it's a very open environment. There are multiple entrances, and you can get to the school from any direction. And kids talk about all the doors to the school. But unfortunately, if we look at policy, we have to have those doors in case of other emergencies like fire. So that's one of those issues where there's no good solution to that. I know of a student who came from abroad, and she attended a school in Malaysia where they are actually had a walled facility and armed guards. They never had an issue, and there was only one entrance to the school. That made the environment safe, but I don't see that as a pragmatic solution to our schools or our environments. We have huge campuses. We have thousands of students, or hundreds at least, and I don't see us being able to do that in our environment. So the solution is kind of tough, and when we discuss that in school, we acknowledge that we don't know what we would do. We have our procedures where we lock the door, turn off the lights, and hurdle in a corner, but like we've all discussed that if Parkland was to happen at our doorstep, we would all like move cabinets and stuff and be more proactive. But essentially, we view ourselves as fish in a barrel when it comes to this situation, that there's nothing we can do. We're in one place, one time.
What a frightening image that creates. Kelly Sechrist, when we were in school, this wasn't really a part of the conversation. No active shooter drills. What do you think about that with your how does it feel to have your kids growing up in an era when this is something that you prepare for?
You know, I actually have thought a lot about this over the years. And even I can remember when they were in kindergarten and thinking, gosh, you know, how scary for them to have to get into the closet with, you know, Mrs. Tagg, or how scary for them to have to, you know, move furniture or whatever they might have to do. I remember doing tornado drills and fire drills and those things when we were growing up. But to really, you know, think about what that does to how they view their world is heartbreaking, because then we're dealing in fear. And I think that's possibly one of the root causes of what's happening with these kinds of events. You know, when we deal with things in fear, when we're fearful of mental illness, or we're fearful of, you know, we add more guns because we're fearful, I think that really, you know, pushes us toward a more violent society. And I feel like these kids are growing up with that knowledge in the back of their mind that school is not safe, the movie theater is not safe, the baseball stadium's not safe. And I'm sad about that.
We've heard, Cooper, some people say American culture with its violent video games is part of the reason this is happening. And I'm going to let you address that when we come back from this break. That's our cue. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. Kelly Sechrist, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back, we're going to hear from a local high school student who spent the first part of his childhood in Austrian schools, and we'll find out how that compares to his experience in the U.S. After this break, you'll have one more segment to get your comment into this live discussion. On Thursday, we're going to hear from Peter, who sent an email about the Second Amendment in a little while. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. After the February 14th school shooting, the gun conversation in this country took a different turn. Reuters reports that Republican candidates in tight congressional races around the country are changing their statements on gun control. The kids from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida are continuing their rounds on network and cable news to advocate for gun control. And Florida's legislature just passed a gun control bill. So what is the conversation like in the Cape Fear region? Do students feel safe in school? We're talking with three students from Hoggard High School today, and joining us now is Julian Fisher. He was born in Austria and moved to this country 4 years ago. He is part of the International Baccalaureate Program, is involved in youth and government, and is currently a senior at Hoggard High School. Julian Fisher, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And still with us is Cooper Whitehead. He's also a senior at Hoggard High School. And we're pleased that Cooper could stay with us throughout the program today. We want to hear from you on this Thursday. What do you think needs to happen, if anything, to keep local schools safe? You can either call us at 910-343-1138, or you can email us at coastline@whqr.org. This is the last segment, so you have just a few minutes to get your own comment in on this discussion. Cooper, just before we went to break, I asked you about American culture and video games and the violence in video games. Do you think that contributes to the way generations are growing up and seeing violence and guns?
On a personal note, I'm going to say no, although I will acknowledge that video games and violence, we are immersed in that within our culture. I'm going to say that was always present. Following the end of the 19th century, you had this obsession with cowboy culture. In the 1950s and 60s, you had people looking at World War II and seeing our GIs as heroes. Vietnam kind of changed that, but I'm still going to say within our youth, there's always been a attraction to violence, whether it's in the movies or now video games. Right now, there are two video games that are out that are called or classified as Battle Royale, and the whole point of these games are to kill all the other players and you win as an individual. It's kind of like the Hunger Games, but I see no connection to these video games for the average child and violence. I believe that it's an issue of reality. If you can perceive reality, what you do in the real world versus a virtual world, I don't see that as an issue. Just like I don't see little kids in the 1950s running around pretending they're the Lone Ranger as an issue. I know a lot of people that when they grew up, they would have toy guns and they would have real guns, and you knew which one to play with and knew which one to respect and only to break out when it was time to hunt or a time to shoot. Like, I feel like this is an issue of perceiving reality, but I don't believe that the video games contribute to violence on a large scale or even a scale that's negligible.
You're nodding, Julian Fisher. What do you see as the biggest differences between American culture around guns and violence and what you remember of Austria?
Well, so my most vivid memory from first visiting the United States was probably on my 13th birthday when my parents were still looking for a house to buy in the States, and we went to Las Vegas. And there I was actually able to fire an AR-15 at a closed shooting range. And it really left an impact on me. It really showed me the culture around guns in the United States. And I think it can be a safe and good culture if it's in those closed environments. But then again, we have to look at the real world here. That's not where guns are used most of the time. And just going off of what Cooper said about violent video games, I think that you hit the nail on the head when you said that there's always been this culture of violence, especially in Hollywood, and that there's always been outrage against that. But there are countless studies that I've seen that suggested there isn't really a correlation between a degradation of mental health and playing violent video games. So I'd say there are more factors that play into it, and I wouldn't really point to violent video games as being the cause.
So what do you think are the factors that play into the gun violence here?
Well, so as has been stated already earlier, mental health, just in general, I think that's a big part of it. And just in Austria, looking at the gun regulations there, an individual is required to submit a certificate of your psychological standing when you apply for firearms. You have to be evaluated by a certified psychologist in order to apply for the various types of documentation needed to purchase a firearm. And I think that would be a great policy idea here in the United States. This is a discussion about policy as well as just the impact on our local community. And so, yeah, mental health, definitely the biggest part. As Cooper has said before, I was listening on the show, it's not the guns that always kill people. It's more so the individual pulling the trigger.
And I promised I would get to Peter's email, the intent of the Second Amendment. What country can preserve its liberties if their rulers are not warned from time to time that their people preserve the spirit of resistance? Let them take arms. Cooper, do you know where that quotation comes from?
Is that from Jefferson?
Yes.
I thought so.
Let me just finish what Peter says here. He says, it's not about hunting. It's not about target shooting. It's not even about self-defense. The Second Amendment was a tool forged in the fire of a violent revolution and included in the Constitution to ensure we would never again face the tyranny that sparked that revolution. For anyone who claims that an armed population could not stand up to tanks and jets, I will point out that we have been fought to a 16-year standoff by a force using nothing more than true assault rifles and homemade explosives. We must also wonder, writes Peter, what percentage of the men and women driving those tanks and flying those planes would be fighting side by side for the preservation of the Constitution they have sworn to defend. What do you say to Peter?
Well, I feel like Peter's stance on the Constitution hit the nail on its head. That is the why we have our Constitution, is to protect the civilian body against a tyrannical government. And what I have, if we can trust an 18-year-old to be drafted and to be sent to war and to do anything from pilot an aircraft carrier or to just serve on the grounds of as an infantryman, I feel like that's basis for our constitutional rights with guns. But what we need to do is secure society and put measures in that prevent the wrong people from getting guns. I'm not opposed to anyone having a firearm. It's just the wrong people. If we can trust a 14-year-old in driver's ed driving a 2-ton metal box at 60 miles per hour, I don't see an individual with owning a firearm. It's just who that individual is. And so I completely agree with him. And kind of back to what Charlie said with the guns and this whole issue.
And you're talking about Julian.
Yes,
we're referring to him as Julian.
Friends refer me by Charlie.
On a personal note. Yeah. But the majority of homicides inflicted by firearms in the U.S. are inflicted by handguns. And that when we look at these issues that come up, like the school shootings, it's the outliers that stand out, the assault rifles and whatnot, or the assault style weapons, excuse me. And I think that there just needs to be some more, there needs to be more distinction in our laws clarifying what type of weapon we're dealing with and who can buy it and what clarifications or classifications you need to meet to purchase that. And I think that we really need to look in that, because most of the gun violence in the United States doesn't happen with mass shootings on school campuses. Around 90% of gun deaths are inflicted by pistols in low-income environments. And so I just feel like our gun culture, we focus on niche points, and that if we want to solve gun culture as a whole, we have to look at who's buying the firearms and what qualifications they have to own them, like Charlie was saying.
And I do just want to say something about studies on guns and gun violence and research. There was a very recently published RAND report by the RAND Corporation nonprofit that took a look at this, and looking at a wide range of studies, the basic conclusion from this was gun control research is very limited because of a 1996 amendment, the Dickey Amendment. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have been barred from doing research on this. And for that reason, we need more research. Each time a study is cited, it's easy to poke holes in that, and that's one of the directions that we're going to go in a different conversation. But right now we have Richard from Jacksonville. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. What's your comment about the conversation?
Well, you know, as a father who has a daughter in school, and as a responsible gun owner and a very avid supporter of the Second Amendment, personally, I would like to see armed personnel in school. And the reason I say that is because all of our politicians and their families are protected by firearms. You know, our police have firearms to defend themselves. You know, airports are defended by armed personnel, stadiums. I mean, the list goes on and on. Most pawn shops have more protection than a school. And it's hard to legislate evil, and there's real evil in the world, and evil people who will walk around and do things just because they can or want to.
And so are you saying arm teachers or arm other
not necessarily arming teachers? If somebody felt comfortable enough and they had the discipline and the skill to do so, then, you know, that would be a choice that they could make. But, you know, either getting some volunteers or some sort of private security, something.
Thanks so much for your observations, Richard. Appreciate that. You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with two seniors at Hoggard High School about their views on the gun conversation since the Parkland, Florida shooting in which 16 people were killed. You have just a few minutes left to get your comment in. You can either call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Brian from Wilmington says, when the Constitution was written, it was about muskets, not assault rifles. And he also says, if you arm teachers, you can't just train them once. It would have to be ongoing, and that would be expensive. With regards to the SRO in Florida, if he had responded, no one would have died? He asks, no. Julian Fisher, when you think about the way Americans view gun rights and the discussion around Second Amendment rights, where do you think we get it wrong? Do you think we're a little, do we look a little gun crazy here compared to your culture in Austria?
Well, so I definitely agree with the constitutional argument of owning guns to hold the government accountable. I completely believe in that. And in Austria, there is a similar system where every male in the country has to serve, I think it's a period of 8 months in the military where they receive training with firearms. And while it's much harder to actually purchase a firearm in Austria, you do get military training as a civilian. And so I think that it kind of serves a similar purpose of defending the laws of the land. And so I wouldn't say that the United States is really gun crazy. I would just say that they're definitely, like one of the callers stated, there needs to be more regulation to keep guns out of the hands of genuinely evil people who want to use those firearms to do harm to innocent civilians.
Why do you think it's been so hard up to this point to prevent that?
Well, I personally think a really big part of that is the gun lobby in Washington, D.C. The NRA has put decades of money into funding gun legislation, and so I think that has been a big part in also what you stated earlier with that amendment that prevents research into this issue. So I think the heart of the problem is in D.C. with our lawmakers.
We had Diane call in from Wilmington. She says, to stop school violence, the doors should only be locked from the inside, not outside. I was a teacher. There is no way I would ever be able to shoot someone. And Tara writes, I'm tired of hearing about gun enthusiasts repeatedly standing by an ancient Second Amendment written 200 years ago to validate their reasons for supporting weapons. Guns are far different now than what our forefathers had in mind when writing that amendment. And that's the second person that we've heard from who's essentially said our forefathers were talking about muskets, not the kinds of weapons that we have today. Julian.
Well, so at the time, the British colonizers were using muskets, and so that our forefathers used muskets to gain independence. Nowadays, the government has much more advanced technology and equipment to potentially instill a tyrannical government. And so the Second Amendment still holds that people should be armed with similar means to protect themselves. And so I personally disagree with the argument that this law only applies to muskets. I think it's fundamentally about defending liberty.
Cooper Whitehead, are you familiar with this bill that was recently passed in the Florida legislature that raises, and I'm not asking if you've read every page, but the basic takeaways from it, raising the minimum age, creating a waiting period that's at least 3 days from the date of purchase, arming school employees, funding for mental health services?
I haven't read it in detail, but I've seen the highlights from it. And as an individual, I'm not opposed to it. I see it as a preservation of constitutional rights and kind of a step up for smart gun control, keeping guns out of the wrong hands. And if I may respond to the previous remarks regarding muskets, guns aren't the only issue or way people take someone out. Of course, with school shootings, this is how this happened. But the most violent school shooting, or the one that inflicted the most death in Virginia Tech, killed 32 students, and that was carried out with handguns, not rifles, and I think that should be noted. But people don't need a gun to do damage. If you look at Europe, what people can do with a truck during a celebration, it's very scary. And I feel like that keeping weapons out of certain people's hands is definitely the main point. But if you want to hurt someone to such a degree, I feel like these people are going to find other means of doing it. But with regards to Florida and their law, I think it's a good first step in the right direction.
And just a minute or so left, Jamie from Wilmington called in, said, to arm teachers, not appropriate. It is circular reasoning that gun owners use to stop guns, more guns. Julian Fisher, are you involved in any efforts in school now to move the ball forward on this issue?
Well, so I've been talking with the organizers of the March 14th walkouts that are going to be happening at Hoggard High School, so just kind of organizing together with them. And as you mentioned, I've also been involved in youth and government. My bill proposal that I actually wrote with Cooper was about banning bump stocks, so directly involved gun regulation.
That's great. Thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Yeah. And thanks also to Kelly Sechrist and Tia Johnson. Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Caitlin Hanrahan, today's chief engineer. Caroline DeVries is our webmaster. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast, find it on the WHQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 2. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.